Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The problem of agriculture is as old as civilization. David Montgomery is a MacArthur Fellow and professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's an internationally renowned geologist who studies landscape evolution. His latest book is called Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Health. He's coming to Sioux Falls for the 2017 South Dakota Association Conservation District's annual convention. That's September 17th through the 19th. But first, he stops by In the Moment. Dr. Montgomery joins us from Seattle. Welcome, sir.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So not many people have a trilogy of books about dirt on their resume. Give me an idea of how that sort of came about, and then we'll talk about the most recent book.
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's a very small club of people who have written trilogies about soil. But you know, I'm a geologist by training and background, and so how I first got into looking at soil was actually looking backwards through history and thinking about the role that soil erosion played in the demise of civilizations. And when I was an undergrad, I read a book by a couple of Soil Conservation Service scientists that was called Topsoil and Civilization, and it really made a big impression on me. And then decades later, I wanted to essentially update the argument that those gentlemen had made and look at the way that how we've treated our land has affected humanity over sort of the long haul, the kind of time frames geologists tend to look at. And it really came to the realization that, you know, the way we treat our land really sets the way that the land will treat society, civilization over the long run. And then that led to the first book, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, and the second piece in the trilogy was really motivated by buying a house in North Seattle, where I live. I teach at the University of Washington, and our lot came with little dirt, not soil. There was nothing living in it when we started to try and make a garden out of the place. And the second book in the trilogy relates my wife and my experience trying to improve our soil enough to support a garden, and what we learned along the way about the role of microbial life, fungi and bacteria in soil fertility was really eye-opening. And then the third book, the recent one that just came out and that I'll be mostly, I'll be partially talking about when I'm out in your neighborhood next week, really came from trying to look at farms around the world and see how we can apply the principles of farming that cultivates beneficial soil life to bring soil health, under the rubric of soil health is what people are talking about today, how that could actually influence farming practices. And I was incredibly impressed with what the farmers that I visited had really managed to do in terms of restoring fertility to their soil, sort of undoing this long-term pattern that I'd seen in that first book.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about history by going back. And I'm wondering, what are some of those early, the early evidence that the way people treated the soil had lasting implications on their society?
Well, you know, you can look at societies around the world that engaged in plow-based agriculture, tillage, for a long period of time, centuries to millennia. And it's really kind of it's kind of a graveyard of empires, I think was even one of the chapter titles that I used. You look at Mesopotamia, you look at Lebanon and Syria, North Africa, classical Greece, ancient Rome. There's really good archaeological evidence in those places that there used to be much richer and more fertile soil. There's great tax records from Syria, for example, a place we don't sort of think of as a agricultural powerhouse today. It's much more of a desolate basket case. They were supporting Rome with wheat exports back around the time of Christ. And so there's really good historical records that some of these areas that today we would not imagine could have been agricultural powerhouses in the past, that they once were. And putting that story together was really what I tried to do in Dirt for societies around the world. And you basically see a pretty similar pattern of slow degradation of the soil from erosion that's associated with tillage, with plow-based agriculture. And that's partially why I got so interested in looking into the development of no-till agriculture in the 20th century and how that had been starting to take off and where that may actually go in terms of merging it with other practices to build a much more soil-friendly, soil-building, and in the end, farmer-friendly style of agriculture.
Can you relate the problems in Syria today with soil degradation of the past, or is that too much of a stretch?
Well, you know, that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, there's some pretty long-term serious political problems and some
right.
Real short-term political problems there. But I think what it's fair to say is that societies that degrade their land to the point where it's very difficult to support and feed a prosperous populace, that implies a lot of stress in societies, and a lot of other things can flow from that. So I think what we could do is we could look at the example of, say, Syria or Libya today as good examples of what we sure don't want to repeat, you know, in the coming centuries into the future. And that's the if you look at the 21st century, sort of playing out the rest of this century, we've got the problem of a rising global population. And if we continue to degrade the ability of our land to actually produce the food that will feed not us but our neighbors, that will ultimately cause tension and instability in some places of the world. And in a global society, you know, regional instability can quickly blow up to international significance.
So how long does soil restoration take? Is it something that humans can do in a reasonable amount of time?
You know, if you asked me that question when I wrote the Dirt book, I would have given you sort of the standard answer of, well, it takes 500 years to make an inch of soil. It's a really long-term thing, so we should simply not squander soil in the first place, and that is good advice. But what I learned from visiting farmers around the world who are practicing regenerative styles of agriculture that rebuild soil fertility was just how fast it could happen, and I really had not expected that. I'd met people who had really restored fertility to their land in a few decades and had made significant improvements in just a few years. And the person who really taught me that, first of all, was my wife. She's the gardener in our family, and she rebuilt the fertility of the soil in our yard in a little over a decade. Took it from about less than 1% organic matter up to almost 10% organic matter with, you know, compost and mulching and all those cast off Starbucks coffee grounds that Seattle is awash in. Bringing organic matter back to the land was really the key in our yard. And I knew that you couldn't do, you know, Starbucks coffee grounds on large farms across America. So I went out to visit farmers and ask, you know, how they were doing it in terms of people who had rebuilt their soil fertility. And the common theme there is organic matter. And there's three simple practices that can really help build up soil organic matter. You know, no-till agriculture, cover crops to introduce the organic matter and to help fix nitrogen as well, and then having a greater diversity of crops on the land, whether at the same time, sort of with companion cropping and intercropping, or with more diverse crop rotations. Those three elements were the common elements among the farmers I visited around the world that had really restored fertility to their soil. So they needed far fewer amendments and inputs. And they'd done it in remarkably short order, with results within a few years. And the people who'd been doing it for a few decades, they'd literally transformed their soil and almost restored, well, some had fully restored their native organic matter and I believe the native fertility of the land.
You end up at some point in South Dakota. Tell me why South Dakota was an important state to visit, and who did you meet here?
Well, yeah, no, South Dakota was actually a major starting point for me, because if you look on the cover of the Dirt book, it's a Dust Bowl era photograph of a farm and farm machinery, you know, with dust blowing over it in South Dakota. And I met a gentleman named Dwayne Beck, who runs the Dakota Lakes Research Farm that's running collaboration with South Dakota State University, at a couple conferences, and saw him talk and was like, when I started working on this book, I was like, I got to go see his farm, because what he's talking about is exactly the kind of style of agriculture that I want to learn more about. And he was very gracious with his time and took me around on a tour of the farmers he'd been working with and of the research farm, and really introduced me to the specific practices of conservation agriculture, of trying to take no-till and merging it with cover crops, and then experimenting with different rotations, which turned out to be the recipe that these farmers around the world had been using, but with, of course, with different practices in different regions. So Dwayne was really my intellectual guide on getting started on this project that evolved ultimately into the Growing a Revolution book. So I'm really happy to be coming back to South Dakota, because that's really where this book began.
So let's dig into some of these principles one by one and talk about no-till first. What's wrong with the plow? And what is this? What does no-till look like on a small farm, like in your garden? And what does it look like on a big full operation?
Yeah. So what's wrong with the plow? It's that it's on the seal of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Thomas Jefferson's plow. So how could it possibly not be a good thing? Well, if you think like a geologist and you think about the soil as a system that is built over time and that can be eroded or lost over time. So it's not something that will always be there. It's something that's made and lost, but just on time frames that we tend to think of as fairly long term. What a plow does is it does something that's fairly unnatural in terms of landscapes around the world, because after the pass of a plow, the land is bare, and you know you're inverting the soil, you're taking the vegetation that was on top of it, and in the wake of the plow, there's bare soil at the surface. And you just have to go outside and on a really windy day in your part of the world and see it blow off of a plowed field, or in other areas, on a rainy day, you can see the little rills and the gullies that are formed when you leave the surface of the soil bare and vulnerable to wind and rain. Erosion starts to happen at a pace that's faster than you're building back up the soil, whether through whatever your agricultural practices are or through nature's methods. And if you let that run long enough, you can quite literally strip the soil off the landscape. And that was the problem in Syria and Libya. And surprisingly, if you go to some areas of, say, North Carolina, where another area that I visited in the last couple of years and visited with farmers, the topsoil there is literally gone in the Piedmont, the hill country, not quite the high Appalachians, not the coast. But they've been farming long enough now, a couple centuries since colonization, and the rich, thick, black soil that had once covered that landscape is quite literally gone, and the farmers are farming the subsoil. And the subsoil, the sort of the reddish subsoil in that region, is not where the most of the fertility lies. It was in the topsoil. So the real problem with the plow is it allows the erosion of the soil from the top down, and that's how you lose fertility over time. And one of the reasons it happened in society after society is that it happens very slowly. As part of writing the Dirt book, I compiled data on the world, how fast are the world's agricultural fields eroding. And if you take just an average number for the whole planet, which is for plow-based agriculture, which is a bold thing to do, but if you collect all the data and then you take the average, you come up with about a millimeter to millimeter and a half of net soil loss per year. And that's a slow rate when you think about it. Your fingernails grow faster than that, right? It's something we don't really notice day to day or even year to year, but you can notice it over the course of a lifetime. And if you play that out over a few lifetimes, you can radically alter the character and nature of the soil.
If you're just tuning in, my guest, David Montgomery, his new book is called Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Health. He's coming to South Dakota. We'll give you details on that in a minute. But first, let's talk a little bit about what no-till looks like on a full-scale operation.
Yeah, one of the things that has really helped the spread of no-till, well, there's actually two things that really helped the spread of no-till. And one has been the invention of sort of new machinery that allows for planting without great disturbance of the soil. And that was something that, as a geologist, I was unfamiliar with the agricultural technology that had really helped with that. And so at one of the farms that I visited, I walked around following a no-till planter and looked at it and learned how it all worked. And it's really fairly clever, where instead of the kind of disturbance you see with a plow, there's a narrow disc that cuts a trench in the soil. It's the crop residue from the last crop, because with no-till, you want to leave the residue from the last crop on the field and plant through it. So you cut a little, this disc cuts a little trench. These spreaders spread the old residue. You drop seeds down in the trench, and then you close the trench up with some closing wheels on the back end of the no-till planter. And I was really kind of astounded following one of these around as it planted, right, and realizing that if I showed these pictures to my geology classes, you wouldn't be able to tell this is a freshly planted field. There's still a cover of vegetative matter, sort of organic matter, the remains of last year's crop stubble on the surface. And that essentially works as a mulch, and it can help hold moisture in the ground. And it also, as it decays, it helps feed the microbes that in turn can partner with the plants and help feed the plants. But if I showed it to my geology students and said, hey, is this field, potentially subject to erosion? They go, no, it's like covered with it's vegetative matter. It's pretty protected from wind and rain.
So does this become an economic challenge for farmers to invest in the new technology so that they can take the steps that needed to be taken for, a more environmentally based farming?
Yeah, I think that is an issue in terms of if you're going to switch from say you've been in long-term tillage and then you want to switch to no-till, you know, you need some different equipment.
Yeah.
And that's a capital cost. But if you look, what I think I see in looking back through the last few decades is that more and more farmers, as they come up with time to where they are thinking about, you know, needing new equipment, investing in a new round of implements, that they're making the switch to no-till. Because back when I was born in the early 60s, there was almost no no-till farming in North America. It was, you know, a couple percent maybe of cropland. And today it's up to about, I think it's about a third. And to a geologist, that's a really rapid change. To a politician or an agronomist, that may seem like really, really slow change. But if you play that out, you would project that, you know, in a few more decades, we're going to be like well over half. And I actually think that the economics are lining up now that that we're going to see more and more farmers making the shift, because one of the things I was actually really quite pleasantly surprised by in talking with these farmers who had adopted this full set of no-till cover crops and greater diversity in their fields was just how economical it was for them. It was quite profitable. Because they were able to reduce their expenses for diesel, fertilizer, and pesticides. Mm. And I only visited one farm that was an organic farm. I was mostly visiting conventional farmers who had, and I was so impressed with how much many of them had been able to reduce their input use that I started jokingly calling them organic-ish farmers. And it kind of stuck. I liked the term, and they didn't mind, and so it's in the book.
So tell me what it looks like in my garden. Does it matter? Does that mean I'm leaving the residue from last year's garden, not pulling it out, and just planting right there?
Yeah, so in our yard, you know, when we mow the lawn, we leave the lawn clippings now on the lawn, and within like 3 days, the worms that are there now take them down into the ground, and they start chewing on them and start turning them into soil organic matter. In the areas where we have trees, we take the deciduous leaves that fall in the fall, and we don't put them in the yard bin. We spread them back over the ground. And, you know, we get them off the places we don't want them.
Right.
But we basically use it as an organic matter input. And by the spring, it's all decayed and, you know, it didn't just disappear. Most of it's been consumed by organisms and taken down into the soil, where it serves as the fuel for the food web that's powering all the bacteria and the fungi that are breaking down all that organic matter. And what they're doing is they're turning it back into plant-available compounds that our garden plants can take up through their roots. So the key in the garden was, again, no disturbance. So we don't rototill, we don't dig in the garden. We're layering organic matter at the surface and letting the biology do the work.
So how do you plant? How do you plant your seeds?
At one point I accused my wife of having migratory plants because we were moving them around the yard to figure out where they would grow best. And so there's disturbance when you plant initially in a garden. But what we don't do is we're not sort of going in and stirring the organic matter into the ground or doing stuff on an annual basis. And what we've managed to do is turn our yard from a place that originally we were importing organic matter, you know, those Starbucks coffee grounds, our neighbors' leaves that they'd be happy to have us sweep up in the fall, bring that back to our yard. So we were essentially importing and building up our organic matter. Now we've got so much life above ground in the yard that we're a net exporter of organic matter.
Huh. So from a consumer standpoint, what does this look like? I can buy your book, I can read it, I can share it, but what about the food that I'm buying? Is there a way that we've established to support this kind of agriculture as consumers yet?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because I don't think that we have. Because if you walk into a supermarket today, the kind of labels you have are like organic and conventional. That's kind of your sort of bifurcation. And, you know, organic agriculture is not necessarily sustainable, let alone building soil health. Many organic farmers are and do, but it was organic agriculture that helped destroy the Roman Empire. They did not have the benefit of sort of modern conventional agriculture. And if you look at sort of the distinctions, and you're wanting to find food that has been grown according to all three principles of conservation agriculture, we don't really have a good system yet at point of purchase identification. I think we actually could use some kind of a soil health friendly label, a soil friendly label, and these principles of ditching the plow, covering up with cover crops, and growing diversity, they apply just as much to organic agriculture as they do to conventional agriculture. And they can help with both the environmental footprint and also the economics of farms in both scenarios. So what I try and argue in the book is that there's this sort of third dimension to the problem of how to think about agriculture in terms of how do we build soil health. And it's not simply an organic versus conventional question. It's not a GMO versus organic question. These practices can really help across the board. And the point you've just put your finger on in terms of how can a consumer identify it in just walking into a store, it's really difficult. So the best way would be to try and build partnerships with a farmer that you know. So at this point, I would recommend things like farmers markets where you can actually know, well, how did this farmer actually farm?
Are we poised for another agricultural revolution? Do you feel like that's where we're at, or is there much more work to be done to lean into that?
I would say both. And the reason I think I can get away with that is, as a geologist, if we pull this transition to a more soil health-friendly agriculture off over the next 20 or 30 years, to me, that's screamingly fast. That's truly an agricultural revolution. Mm-hmm. We look back at the agricultural revolutions of the past, the sort of the initial adoption of cultivation and tillage, thousands of years ago, to the ideas of soil husbandry and crop rotation and the power of legumes to put nitrogen in the soil that societies around the world discovered centuries ago, to then the mechanization and industrialization, and then the Green Revolution and biotechnology, the sort of the first four agricultural revolutions really set us up for, I think, this fifth one, where we can try and combine the best of modern technology with the best of ancient wisdom, the idea of crop rotations and cover crops, and combining it with the modern technology that allow no-till agriculture, and that really could revolutionize agriculture. And I think we're at the cut point where we are going to start seeing greater adoption of it. I see a lot of enthusiasm and energy in the agricultural communities where I've gone to give talks, and what I've been most heartened by is that adopting these kind of practices can really help with the bottom line of farms. And so I really think that in terms of national policy, a way we should be promoting these soil health building practices as a way to help America's farmers become more profitable, which I think, and if they can do that in ways that also reduce the environmental footprint of agriculture, everybody wins.
You've been listening to Dr. David Montgomery. His latest book is called Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. You can hear him speak Monday, September 18th at a public lecture on the SDSU campus. He's also the luncheon keynote speaker at the South Dakota Association Conservation District's annual convention. That talk is also on Monday. We reached him today in Seattle. Dr. Montgomery, thank you so much.
Hey, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.